whatever the name you will call it with, it would take different, you know, it may acquire that shape. I won't say that shape, you know. For example, I'll give an example. Me and my husband had our first child, and mm-hmm. we would call him Dear Mustafa.
Oh, wow. Such a beautiful name.
And when I asked my husband, why this name? Why didn't you even ask me? I'm the mother. You should have asked me why this name. Although that was a very
beautiful... The usual debate of parents.
Yeah. Although that was a very, very beautiful name. And he told me that having first boy in the family and not having the name of my prophet is like a kind of, you know...
Disrespect.
Yeah, I really do want to have... we put his name as Mustafa, so we would always call him as Mustafa. But when we went back to India for a summer vacation and we came back, but over there, we kind of... when you know, we play with the cute babies,
uh-huh,
and then
yeah.
we call with them with different names, and we call them... Naughty boy, naughty boy, So we have particular terms to call a boy a naughty boy. And I would see my husband would get offended whenever someone would call my child a naughty boy. I would ask him, what's wrong with you? They are expressing their love towards my child. And that's okay.
No, he's Mustafa.
He was like, no, he's Mustafa. He's not naughty.
Yes.
If you call him naughty, he would...
It would be
a naughty boy.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like,
that's
how?
Really right, though.
I was like, how? And he gave me this example of this Japanese researcher who mm-hmm. had done research on the water, calling it by different names and acquiring different shapes. Since human body is considered of water more than 70%, it definitely does have, takes that.
Zainab,
you know, if you put water in a vessel, it takes the same shape.
Exactly.
If I'm calling a guy a naughty guy, he mm-hmm. would develop into a naughty person. And then I should not be offended why he developed into a naughty.
Unconsciously, they would get the shape and the impression of that name that's been put on them.
I also think that...
Parents of modern age, are they doing their duty in a very good way?
I really don't think so. I really don't think
so. We hear names that are so archaic.
I mean, I don't know. Are they naming cats? Are they naming dogs? Or are they naming humans?
Exactly,
Like, unfortunately, the names that we hear today, I don't know, just to be trendy.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of trend is this?
Exactly. It's the name
it's
of your
basic
child.
Responsibility.
You shouldn't take it based on trends or whatever that comes out of that.
When you go towards the
just because it's stylish, I would call my child with that name.
It's because we, I'm sorry to say, but we think we're very educated, but we think we are going back. We are going back towards the ignorance and everything and calling us children with... I don't know.
They do. You know what? What they start to do, they actually are going for the things that would please the crowd.
Exactly. You know, I have two sons. My two-year-old is named as Murtaza. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I always call him like Murtaza. And I heard my friend calling him Murtu. Murtu.
Wow. How come?
I was like, come on, what is Murtu?
Yes, and, what is that?
And you know, like I'm saying, unfortunately, people
she actually
think
is trying to pamper him, but that's not the way with that name.
Exactly. I told her, please, you're allowed to do anything, but don't change the name of my son.
Yeah.
She's like, it sounds more trendy. I said, no, it's the name of my Amir al-Mu'mineen. It's the name of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Like, he was called Ali Murtaza. It's the name of like, I don't know, I don't want the names of Ahlul Bayt to get, you know, trendy more, I think. And it changed the meaning.
Exactly.
As it changed the meaning, it just changes the
impact. So it actually is a very beautiful discussion to dig deeper in the topic of naming our children, or the or how names would affect the personality of each character, of each individual.
Yeah.
It would take a very long time. And we already mentioned some points about that. We said that in Islamic heritage, we've been advised from Allah to pick the best names for our children, because that's a duty that the parent would owe to their children.
Because Allah has got wisdom, and definitely names would have had an impact on the personality of a person. So
He knows that it would affect their personality in future. And
so
as
that's
you mentioned,
why you kept one of the biggest responsibilities of parents to name good, not only to name your child, to give them a good name, because everyone names.
Exactly.
You cannot go on with, without names. But one of the responsibilities that was given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was to give them good names.
Yeah. So that's all the time that we've got for today's episode. It was a very, very interesting topic. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Asma, for joining me. Thank you, dear listeners.
Of course, it was a pleasure. Always a pleasure to be with you and with the audience, of course.
Same here. Thank you, dear audience, for listening to us. You are listening to The Youth Station from IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullah.
Wa barakatuhu.
I have what I have. My love is strong. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior. My giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. When I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis. The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The US could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it turned and chose that path, but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration. And they're sending a message by saying, even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect, it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the UN Security Council that criticize the regime.
Amid ongoing diplomatic efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the U.S. has introduced fresh sanctions against Iran. Washington claims the measures target an international network of individuals and entities that allegedly facilitated the sale of Iranian petroleum and petrochemical products to East Asia. The move comes ahead of President Biden's visit to the region next week. Last week, Iran held high-stake diplomatic talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, to restore the JCPOA, with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, shuttling between Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, and Robert Malley, the U.S. special envoy for Iran. Following the talks, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, rejected claims made by U.S. officials about new demands raised by the Iranian delegation in the Doha talks, saying the Islamic Republic's requests are in line with the 2015 accord. He said, contrary to U.S. media claims, Tehran put forward no excessive demands that goes beyond the framework of the JCPOA.
برخلاف برخی ادعاهای رسانه‌ای طرف آمریکایی ما هیچ گونه مطالبه زیاده خواهانه ای نداریم هیچ گونه مطالبه فرابرجامی مورد ادعای آمریکا را نداریم مطالبات ما کاملا در چارچوب توافق سال 2015 است
امیر عبداللهیان's remarks came in response to US special envoy for Iran Robert Malley claimed that Tehran came up with new demands at the Doha talks. The U.S. State Department spokesman, Ned Price, echoed Mali's remarks, claiming that Iran has consistently introduced extraneous demands, demands that, or issues that, go beyond the four walls of the JCPOA. Iran is pursuing the JCPOA talks, while Israel has been sounding the alarm about Iran, its regional influence, and its alleged efforts of weaponizing its nuclear program.
And Israel is far from wanting the interests of the countries of the region. On the other hand, we see that the countries in the region like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, they're talking to each other, they're meeting in Baghdad. They've met several times in Arab and Middle Eastern capitals. So they are capable of sorting out their problems. And therefore, any relationship with Israel would be detrimental and against the interest of the countries of the Middle East.
Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official has warned against forming alliances with Israel, saying that such moves endanger the security of the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says that any alliance with the Israeli regime, even of a non-security and non-military nature, will pose serious threats to the stability and security of the Middle East region. Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He underlined the emphasis on neighboring countries in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, asserting that Tehran's coherent policy towards its neighbors is to expand all-out and strategic relations on the principle of good neighborliness. Separately, Shamkhani warned that the Islamic Republic opposes any move that changes regional geopolitics. This was in reference to a so-called Arab NATO, a plan that was a non-starter when it was introduced by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. This military regional alliance was due to Israel and the U.S. sounding the alarm over the perceived threat coming from Iran.
The Iranophobia is something very natural to happen in the West because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability. The UK Prime Minister fought as hard as he could, but he finally gave in. Boris Johnson has resigned as the Conservative Party leader. This will pave the way for a successor to replace him as the British Prime Minister after over 50 of his ministers quit the government. He will, however, continue as Prime Minister until autumn. A Tory leadership race will take place this summer, and the winner will replace Johnson by October. Boris Johnson's premiership plunged into crisis following the dramatic resignations of Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the Health Secretary Sajid Javid. Javid, who served as the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, made reference to Johnson's failed leadership as the reason for quitting his post.
And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough. Yeah. I believe that point is now.
Further resignations have followed, with the education ministers Will Quince and Robin Walker and ministerial aide Laura Trott quitting.
He had scandal after scandal, miscalculation after miscalculation. He's lost the confidence of, I assume, the country, going by the recent by-election results, and more recently, he's lost the confidence of many senior members of his government, with over 40 of them now resigning.
Johnson was under mounting pressure after apologizing for appointing MP Christopher Pincher to a role involved in offering pastoral care to his party, even after being briefed that the politician had been the subject of complaints about sexual misconduct.
He knew the accused minister had previously committed predatory behavior, but he promoted him to a position of power anyway. Why?
They're looking at the future. They're looking at the next Conservative government being returned in 2024. I believe they feel that won't happen with Boris Johnson at the helm. Therefore, people are jockeying for position. The knives are out. It's a Caesar and Brutus type political ending of his career.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the scandals that surrounded him drowned his political life, and he found himself to have fallen out of favor with the general public in the UK. Prior to his resignation, a snap YouGov poll had found that 69% of Britons thought that Johnson should step down as Prime Minister. The timing of his resignation could not be any worse. The UK is experiencing a cost of living crisis like no other time in its history. Many Britons are struggling to cope with rising fuel and food prices. Economists say that the country is now heading for a sharp slowdown or possibly a recession.
He is, for his own political, selfish purposes, been running this country's economy into the ground, and worse, far worse, he has been threatening a peace process. That's all I've got to say.
And things will get much, much worse before the next general election. And I think regardless of who wins that election, we will continue to see an economic crisis.
Now with a new administration set to take the helm in September or in early October, the real concern for the UK is how it will cope with the economic crisis until then. This is not to dismiss the fact that there are no guarantees that the new administration will be able to deal with the economic onslaught that will be piled on it.
I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says the Federation will be a partner in the lawsuit filed against the Israeli occupation in the International Criminal Court. A member of the executive board of the Federation says the move came after the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate succeeded in persuading the Federation to file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. IFJ stated that the filing comes in light of the Israeli aggression against Palestinian journalists and people. Earlier, the Journalist Syndicate had said that it succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The circumstances of Shirin Abu Akleh's killing on May the 11th have been investigated by several international organizations. All concluded that it was a bullet fired from an Israeli rifle that killed the Al Jazeera correspondent and injured her fellow journalist as they covered an Israeli raid in Jenin. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probes, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. But the question is, will there and can there be accountability for the crimes committed by Israel?
And the absence of punishment shows hypocrisy, double standards, and deception and lies. So this is an opportunity for journalists to present all of the best documented evidence, research, discovery that they've done about crimes against humanity that the Israeli apartheid regime has committed. And the more international they go, the louder they go, the more they invite other countries to be participants, to join the lawsuit against Israel, the more you're building international consensus in support of the people who have been violated, dehumanized, killed, robbed, or in other way injured by this grotesque apartheid Israeli policy and agenda of genocide, bigotry, and destruction. So it's a very essential step, and I'm glad they're taking it.
Earlier this month, Palestinian officials handed over to U.S. forensic experts the bullet that killed Abu Akleh. But despite all the evidence pointing fingers towards Israel, the U.S. said it could not reach a definitive conclusion on the origin of the bullet. Meanwhile, Abu Akleh's family have expressed their anger over the U.S.'s disregard for what several courts and rights organizations have stated and its failure to accept that its ally has murdered a journalist in broad daylight. The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says that Israel was guilty of the crime and expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into Palestinian journalist Abu Akleh's killing. The U.S., on the other hand, has not condemned this act, yet aside from saying there needs to be an independent investigation, raising questions about whether the U.S. is seeking the truth or to protect its ally.
Well, absolutely, the U.S. is guilty of supporting the regime. The U.S. is guilty from enabling the regime to engage in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The U.S. has been guilty of stealing money from the American people and giving it to the Israeli apartheid regime and giving them weapons and, in fact, looking the other way when Israel had developed nuclear weapons. But that's another story. But Israel's crimes and abuses against the Palestinians, against the Syrians, against Lebanon, against all sorts of countries and nations and peoples, the U.S. is the partner in crime that is responsible. And if the U.S. does not hold a moral standard and a very clear objectivity and a dedication to truth and justice, then the U.S. is showing that it has no dedication to truth and justice, but instead has a dedication to lies and crime.
The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measures, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel. Yet no one, including the United Nations Security Council, has used any of its tools to ensure its resolutions. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has ruled that it has a mandate to investigate the occupied territories and has accepted the Palestinians after they were granted non-member observer status at the UN. This comes despite Palestinians' inability to join the ICC, as Israel is not a member and Palestinians do not qualify as a sovereign state.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect for honor. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of respect for honor in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Islam has made some boundaries for every person, and we are bound to live in our limitations or limits, the limits that are set by the Islam. For example, we have mahram, the one like mother, sister, aunt. And similarly for the girls, it is the father, it's the brother, it is the brother of father, which is known as uncle. Obviously, for the brother of mother is also known as the uncle. So these are the maharim or mahram. In front of them, it is said that a lady, she is free to go without hijab. But for those who are non-mahram, which are known as the ones who are stranger in the Islamic terminology, as we use the word non-mahram, for them, she has to wear hijab. So this hijab, this veil, is for the man and woman both. Why? Because Islam talks about respect for honor. And this respect for honor means that you should not exceed the limits that are set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, someone who has the habit of womanizing or maybe having a dirty look on the others, we can say like sister, mother, or, you know, the ones who are non-mahram, even the ones who are non-mahram, this person is exceeding the limits that are set by Islam. He must not exceed these limits. Islam has set these limits where Islam has given the order to women to have the put on the veil. On the other hand, it is said for the man to lower your eyes, lower your gaze, and do not look at the non-mahram, and be in your limits, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of respect of honor in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said that there are the limits that are set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we must be careful when we are talking about these limits. And when we talk about the respect of honor, we have a narration from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where the Prophet has said that laysa minna man khana musliman fi ahlihi wa malihi, and he said that he is not from us whoever betrays the other Muslim's family or the property. And this is very important, because if we do not belong to Prophet, then obviously who do we belong to? Being a Muslim, when we are looking at the Prophet to basically give a favor to us, and with all those actions that we have, with all those mistakes that we have, we are looking forward for the intercession of the Prophet, and we want him to be the Shafi, or does the Shafa'a for us. Therefore, if he says that he's not from us, who, for example, is having the dirty look at the others, we can say honor, or the woman who has the habit of womanizing, and who does not care, who does not respect the honor of the others, the woman of the others, then how can we go to paradise? How can we make ourselves a good person? How can we go towards the perfection? Whereas Islam has come to take us towards the perfection. Therefore, it is necessary, according to the Islamic lifestyle, if you want to have an Islamic lifestyle, if you want to become a role model, therefore, try to have the respect for other. And this is what Islam teaches us for. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. With his criminal trial for contempt of Congress approaching, Stephen K. Bannon, an ally of former President Donald Trump who was involved in his plans to overturn the 2020 election, has informed the House committee investigating the Capitol attack that he is now willing to testify, according to two letters obtained by the New York Times. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Bannon Facing Jail and Fines Agrees to Testify to January 6 Panel. With his criminal trial for contempt of Congress approaching, Stephen K. Bannon, an ally of former President Donald Trump, who was involved in his plans to overturn the 2020 election, has informed the House committee investigating the Capitol attack that he is now willing to testify, according to two letters obtained by the New York Times. His decision is a remarkable about-face for Mr. Bannon, who until Saturday had been among the most obstinate and defiant of the committee's potential witnesses. He had promised to turn the criminal case against him into the misdemeanor from hell for the Justice Department. But with the possibility of 2 years in jail and large fines looming on the horizon, Steve Bannon has been authorized to testify by Donald Trump, his lawyer told the committee late on Saturday, 9th of July. The former president had previously instructed Steve Bannon and other associates not to cooperate with the House panel, claiming that executive privilege, a president's power to withhold certain internal executive branch information, especially confidential communications involving him or his top aides, compelled them to stay silent. But in recent days, as several witnesses have come forward to offer the House panel damning testimony about Donald Trump's conduct, Mr. Trump has grown frustrated that one of his fiercest defenders has not yet appeared before the committee, people close to him have said. Steve Bannon is willing to and indeed prefers to testify at your public hearing, Robert J. Costello, Mr. Bannon's lawyer, wrote to Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, and the chairman of the House committee. Mr. Costello said that Steve Bannon's decision to comply with the committee's subpoena came after he was cleared to testify by Donald Trump. He provided the panel with a letter that Donald Trump sent to Steve Bannon on Saturday that waived any claim to executive privilege over his testimony or documents relevant to the subpoena. Our position about the committee remains unchanged, but President Trump wants Mr. Bannon to tell the committee the truth, Mr. Costello said on Sunday, 10th of July. He said Steve Bannon planned to supply the committee with documents as well as testimony. The House Committee and the Justice Department have long maintained that Donald Trump has no valid claim of executive privilege over Mr. Bannon's testimony, in part because Steve Bannon left the White House in 2017 and was a private citizen when he was involved in Mr. Trump's efforts to hold on to power after the 2020 presidential election. When you first received a subpoena to testify and provide documents, I invoked executive privilege, Donald Trump wrote in his letter to Steve Bannon on Saturday. However, I watched how unfairly you and others have been treated, having to spend vast amounts of money on legal fees and all of the trauma you must be going through for the love of your country and out of respect for the office of the president. Therefore, he continued, if you reach an agreement on a time and place for your testimony, I will waive executive privilege for you, which allows for you to go in and testify truthfully and fairly, as per the request of the Unselect Committee of Political Thugs and Hacks. Steve Bannon's trial on two counts of criminal contempt of Congress is set for 18th of July. Each count carries a penalty of up to a year in jail and a $100,000 fine. It remains to be seen how Steve Bannon's new posture will affect the criminal proceeding and how forthcoming he will be. He could refuse to speak about certain topics, citing the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, as some other witnesses have done. But the committee has repeatedly said that it needs to hear from Steve Bannon and receive the documents it requested from him about plans to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We got the letter around midnight from his lawyer saying that he would testify, and we have wanted him to testify, Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California and a member of the House Committee, told CNN on Sunday. Lofgren added, so the committee, of course, has not yet had a chance to discuss it, but I expect that we will be hearing from him, and there are many questions that we have for him. Should Steve Bannon ultimately appear for an interview, he would give his testimony behind closed doors like the hundreds of other witnesses have done, Ms. Lofgren said. The committee has carefully choreographed its public hearings to make a streamlined presentation of its case and has worked to avoid public sparring sessions with witnesses. For months, Steve Bannon has been perhaps the most bombastic and strident potential witness the committee has called to testify. He refused to turn over a single document or sit for a minute of testimony. For his intransigence, the House voted in October to hold Steve Bannon in criminal contempt of Congress. But the panel has insisted that Mr. Bannon, Donald Trump's former chief strategist and counselor, could help investigators better understand the January 6, 2021 attack, which was meant to stop the certification of President Biden's victory. On his radio show on 5th of January 2021, Steve Bannon promised that all hell is going to break loose tomorrow, a statement that shows he had some foreknowledge about extreme events that would occur the next day, the committee said in a report. Investigators have also pointed to a conversation Steve Bannon had with Donald Trump on 30th of December 2020, in which he urged him to focus his efforts on 6th of January, the day that Congress was to make the official count of electoral votes to confirm Joe Biden's victory. Steve Bannon was also present at a meeting at the Willard Hotel in Washington the day before the violence, when plans were discussed to try and overturn the results of the election the following day. Steve Bannon's criminal case is just the latest against him. Federal prosecutors indicted and arrested him in 2020 in Manhattan, New York, on charges relating to money raised to promote the construction of the border wall, long sought by Donald Trump. But before facing trial, he was preemptively pardoned by Donald Trump just hours before the former president left office.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam's endeavor to bring about a serious separation from Westerners would have naturally created some enemies because he would not allow them to interfere. He took the current Palestinian embassy, which was in the hands of the usurping Zionist regime at that time, away from the Zionists and handed it over to the Palestinians, who are the owners of Palestine. Well, this naturally brings about enmity. This is the course of nature. Our youth must pay attention to this. Westerners looted the world for three centuries. For three centuries, they looted the world. Westerners looted the whole world, ranging from Eastern Asia, Indonesia, the Philippines, and the Indian subcontinent, to Central Asia, West Asia, North Africa, West Africa, and the entire sub-Saharan region of the continent. And they were not satisfied with that either. They even laid their hands on South America. They looted the American continent as well. The American continent had its own owners. It had a civilization with certain nations. They created disaster with various tricks. All these are clear in authoritative history books. You should read books in order to understand these matters more tangibly.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They engaged in murder, plunder, massacre, torture, pressure, and slavery. Westerners did these things during those 3 centuries. While Westerners were busy committing these crimes, their intellectuals and thinkers would discover and impose human rights for the world. This contradiction in action and in words, and this hypocrisy is clear. Their actions and words were different. European countries, followed by US, committed all sorts of crimes throughout the world in the literal sense of the word. Well, these are the masterpieces of the Western civilization. These are the works of art created by Westerners. Imam knew these things well. One of the main issues on which Imam would insist was to create a distance and border between the Islamic thinking, lifestyle, and government from Western governments. This was one of the major concerns of Imam.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
In the limelight.
Without wild species, our whole planet unravels, said one scientist in response to new UN-backed report. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Biodiversity Destruction Imperils Natural Species Crucial to Humanity's Survival. Stay tuned for more. A new report backed by the UN warned recently that humans must ramp up efforts to sustainably use and protect the world's flora and fauna to avoid the extinction of thousands of species which billions of people rely on for survival every day, whether they know it or not. After more than 4 years of preparation by 85 experts from around the world, drawing from scientific data as well as indigenous people's knowledge, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, IPBES, released its report showing that people across the globe depend on 50,000 wild plant and animal species for food, energy, medicine, and other purposes. Pablo Pacheco, an author of the report and a scientist at the Worldwide Fund for Nature, said, without wildest fishes, our whole planet unravels, adding billions of people rely on wildest fishes for food, medicine, energy, and clean water. As IPBES reported in a separate study in 2019, unsustainable exploitation and destructive practices, including overfishing, the climate crisis, and continued extraction of fossil fuels, deforestation, and pollution are pushing 1 million species towards extinction. According to the new report, 12% of wild tree species are threatened by unsustainable logging practices, and unsustainable hunting is imperiling 1,341 wild mammal species. More than a third of marine wild fish stocks are overfished, and nearly 450 shark and ray species are identified as threatened, also largely due to over-exploitation. The recent report reveals how dangerous these trends are for humanity and calls for a number of changes to how people interact with the natural world. Overexploitation is one of the main threats to the survival of many land-based and aquatic species in the wild, said John Donaldson, co-chair of IPBES, addressing the causes of unsustainable use and whether possible reversing these trends will result in better outcomes for wild species and the people who depend on them. Sustainable use is particularly important for the security of people in the Global South, as about 70% of the world's poorest people directly depend on wild species. Nearly 2.5 billion people, about one-third of humanity, rely on fuel wood for cooking, especially in developing countries. With about 50,000 wild species used through different practices, including more than 10,000 wild species harvested directly for human food, rural people in developing countries are most at risk from unsustainable use with lack of complementary alternatives, often forcing them to further exploit wild species already at risk, said report co-author Jean-Marc Fromentin. The report highlights a number of recommendations, largely drawing from sustainable practices that have been used for generations by indigenous people around the world. For example, the IPBES pointed to the people in the Cordillera region of Luzon in the Philippines, who practice batkan, with community members participating in monitoring the diversity of forests and planting new trees when older ones die. The report also calls for policies reducing illegal and unregulated fishing to replenish fish stocks, support for small-scale fisheries, investments in technology that would reduce waste in the manufacturing of wood products, and the recognition of land tenure for indigenous people. We live on a planet with limited resources and we must treat it that way, said Pacheco, adding, the good news is that sustainable and equitable use of wild species is possible if we address the biodiversity crisis from both a social and ecological lens. We must co-create policies with indigenous people and local communities who manage approximately 40% of terrestrial conserved areas and have developed a rich generational knowledge of these biodiversity-rich landscapes, he added. This should be part of a wider alignment of global processes and national policies and targeted local actions.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace. Just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but it didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Absana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic, anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
After 2 years of waiting for the Hajj, caravans of pilgrims and lovers of the sacred house of God have converged on Mecca. Nearly 40,000 Iranian pilgrims were also among the 850,000 foreign pilgrims who have visited Saudi Arabia for 2022 Hajj. Many of them have been waiting for years for their turn.
After 17 years of waiting, I was able to visit this holy place, and I hope all Iranians could one day travel to this sacred land.
I've traveled to Mecca after 15 years of waiting, and I hope all